Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 697, Christian Fundamentalism and the Underground Reich. This program has been recorded on December 13th of the year 2009. As always, in order to flesh out your understanding of the discussion that is supplemental in this program, please use the Spitfire website, spitfirelist.com. It is the best source available for information of this kind. I've got my entire life's work up there for download for free. And the only investment you need to make to take advantage of it is one of time. We left off at the end of For the Record program number 696, with some discussion of a book that's getting a fair amount of publicity and that is generating a fair amount of journalistic gravitas, at least for a book that is an expose and a very damning one of that of some of the most powerful interests in our society and beyond that worldwide. This book is called The Family, subtitled The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. It's authored by Jeff Charlotte, and it is getting a fair amount of discussion on NPR and other networks, and it is slowly, well, maybe not so slowly, filtering into a public awareness. Now, what this book does is to talk about a secretive but very, very powerful, even seminally powerful, Christian fundamentalist organization called The Family, or The Fellowship. It was begun in the 1930s by a fellow named Abraham Varide, a Norwegian immigrant, who, by the way, will be known in this book for the most part as Abram. That was simply how he came to be called. He was that much of an icon and a revered figure that it was simply Abram. It's kind of like the Donald for Donald Trump. They didn't have to say Abraham Varide or Abram Varide. In this book, Jeff Charlotte talks about how the Christian fundamentalist right networks with some of the most powerful elements in our society. He discusses the fact that the family adopted many fascist viewpoints in the 1930s, and as we saw last week, the family was deeply involved with the rehabilitation of Nazis and their inclusion in the, quote, new, unquote, Federal Republic of Germany. We're going to take a much deeper look at the relationship between the family and the Third Reich, not only in the pre-World War II and World War II periods, but in particular, we're going to take a look at the relationship between the family or fellowship. Again, a seminal and decisively powerful Christian organization inextricably linked with American power structure. We're going to take a look at its links with the Underground Reich. A lot of people, I think, are easily, and this is not in any way to be judgmental, but they are easily confused or distracted by the use of the term conspiracy theory. I myself don't particularly like using that term in connection with the work that I do here. I think a much more useful term, one that's not only more useful for understanding what we're talking about, but one that's much more useful for approaching it from an intelligent standpoint and avoiding a lot of the rhetorical BS that generally goes along with the demeaning term of conspiracy theory. And that term is networking. What we're going to be looking at in this program is networking. We're going to be taking a look at networking between Third Reich spies in the pre-World War II period and the American power elite, many of whose members had helped to finance Hitler, many of whose members were sympathetic to Hitler, many of whose, and by the way, many of whose most powerful members, I should say, were involved in the attempt at overthrowing Franklin Roosevelt in 1934. The Third Reich's elite was very strongly connected with that of this country. And it was the received wisdom of many of the elites around the world that the U.S. as well as Britain should hook up with Germany, Japan, and Italy and fight against the former Soviet Union. In this book, we're going to take a look, or in this program, we're going to take a look at networking between Third Reich spies and the American elite in the run-up to World War II. This in an attempt at helping to cement the transatlantic financial and industrial axis that was instrumental in bringing fascism to pass. We've spoken about that in many programs, including the Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast. It can be examined at great length in the mini library of old anti-fascist books that is available for download for free on the Spitfire List website. We're going to take a look, too, at how many of these people, particularly a spy slash journalist named Manfred von Zapp, and or Manfred Zapp, and also a fellow named von Gienand, who was the SS slash Gestapo chief in North America, they eventually became close associates and operatives of Abram Varide and the family and or fellowship in post-war Germany, and they also helped to facilitate the networking between the fellowship and American conservatives and fascists and their German counterparts. What we're going to be looking at here, again, is a window into what I call the Underground Reich, literally a Third Reich that went underground, and how it networks with and how it profoundly influences the reactionary establishment in the United States. And in particular, we're going to take a look at how the Underground Reich fits into, dovetails with the power structure of the Christian Right, which in turn has spawned many names that are, if not household words, certainly readily recognizable to anybody with even a passing familiarity of American fundamentalism. Jeff Charlotte's The Family, published in softcover by Harper Perennial Books. And we're going to take a look at the networking between the family, the epicenter, arguably, of Christian fundamentalism in the United States, and the Third Reich in its above-ground period and in its post-war underground Reich period. This by way of hooking up an important element of the discussion that I present, namely the Underground Reich and the Bormann Capital Network, with a phenomenon that is receiving a fair amount of discussion in the journalistic community in this country. First two names we're going to be looking at, Manfred Zapp and later Baron von Gienand. Manfred Zapp, a native of Dusseldorf by way of Pretoria, South Africa, merited a line in the news when he stepped from an ocean liner onto the docks of New York City on September 22, 1938, a warm, windy day at the edge of a South Atlantic hurricane. Just a few words in the New York Times Ocean Travelers column, a list of travelers of note buried in the back of the paper. By the time he left the United States, however, his departure would win headlines, skipping down. Zapp had been given charge of the American offices of the Trans-Ocean News Agency, ostensibly the creation of a group of unnamed German financiers. He had recently left a similar post in South Africa. It is of paramount importance, the German chargé d'affaires in Washington had written Zapp the month before his arrival, that a crossing of wires with the work of the DNB, the Deutschland News Bureau, be absolutely avoided, unquote. DNB was transparently the tool of the Nazi regime and thus under constant scrutiny. Transocean, on the other hand, as an allegedly independent agency, might operate more freely. My task here in America is so big and so difficult, Zapp wrote the German ambassador to South Africa a month after he arrived, that it demands all my energies, unquote. What was Zapp's task? During his American tenure, he flitted in black tie and tails from Fifth Avenue to Park Avenue, enjoying the hospitality of rich men and beautiful women. The gossip columnist Walter Winchell wrote of Zapp's, quote, madcap girlfriend, unquote, a big-spending society girl who seemed to consume at least as much of Zapp's attention as the news. He avoided as much as he could discussions of what he considered the tedium of politics. His friends knew that he had dined with Cordell Hull, the Secretary of State, and with Franklin Delano Roosevelt himself, and some must also have known that he had worked quietly and illegally, if one must be technical, against the president's re-election. But one did not ask questions. He traveled, though no one was quite sure where he went off to. One moment he was hovering over the teletype in Manhattan, the next he was to be found in Havana on the occasion of a meeting of foreign ministers. Some might have called him a Nazi agent, there to encourage Cuba's inclinations. A popular radio program transmitted across the Caribbean was called the Nazi Hour. But Zapp could truthfully reply that he rarely stirred from the lobby of the Hotel Nacional, where he sat sipping cocktails, happy to buy drinks for any man, or preferably lady, who cared to chat with him. Note here that the Transocean News Agency, actually a front for German propaganda and espionage, but one set up by the very German industrialists, many of whom were networking with their American counterparts and with whom they shared a fascist outlook. And note also that Zapp was part of a Nazi and fascist fifth column in the Caribbean. Skipping down, we're going to take a look at some of Zapp's fascist ideology. And interestingly enough, Zapp preferred the term totalitarianism to fascism. We saw an echo of this in the early 1980s when Ronald Reagan's ambassador to the United Nations, Jean Kirkpatrick, differentiated between totalitarian and authoritarian regimes, the totalitarian being the communist and authoritarian being merely fascist. I think in some ways that's similar to the distinction made here by Zapp. Skipping down. To Zapp, totalitarianism, the term he preferred to fascism, was, once pruned of its absurdities, a sensible and lovely idea. The torches and the long knives, the death's head, and all of that red-faced singing and table-pounding, these activities Zapp did not care for. He actually preferred life in America, the canyons of Manhattan, and the gin-lit balconies of the city's best people, conversations that did not begin and end with barking devotion. Heil Hitler. Zapp signed his letters with this invocation, and a portrait of the Führer hung in his office, but Zapp the journalist was too sensitive a recording device to enjoy all that arm-snapping. If only Manhattan and Munich, Washington and Berlin could be merged. It was a matter not of warfare, but of harmony. Democracies bickering in bile giving way to the new conception, unquote, in which power and will would be won. Within a year, however, Zapp found cause to resist returning to that fine new system. After a series of unsolved murders and perplexing explosions and intercepted transmissions led the FBI to raid Nazi front organizations in Boston, Baltimore, Buffalo, Denver, New Orleans, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, and Zapp's Spartan office of Fifth Avenue itself, where they found what they believed to be evidence of the orchestration of it all, and Zapp began to reconsider his enthusiasm for Hitler's new order. He had failed the Führer. How would his will judge him? What power would be exerted in the Gestapo beating rooms that Transocean employees had once considered themselves privileged to tour? The FBI seized him and his chief deputy and whisked them away to cold, bare rooms on Ellis Island, no less, where not long before the rabble of Europe had been processed into mongrel America, land of, quote, degenerate democracy, unquote, as Roosevelt himself quoted Zapp in a speech denouncing Germany's strategy of terror, unquote. This last phrase, as applied to Zapp's pursuits, was perhaps unfair. We now know why Nazi sabotage efforts failed, the Washington Post would announce after the war. Zapp and his fellow Nazi spies had been too busy bickering. And note here, something of a demarcation a fault line in the nature of the Nazi Fifth Column in the U.S., in addition to the representatives of the financial and industrial elite in the aristocracy, such as Zapp, there were other people, although himself an aristocrat, another of Abram Varide's post-war fellowship operatives, in addition to Manfred Zapp, who we're looking at here, Baron von Ginot was in charge of SS activities and Gestapo activities in North America. Continuing. On one side were saboteurs of the old line, men who planted little bombs disguised to look like chewing gum and set giant fires meant to be understood by Washington as arson, skulking and hulking figures who photographed munitions factories and murdered German-American informants they suspected of disloyalty to their dishonest cause. On the other were men such as Zapp, along with a D.C.-based diplomat named Ulrich von Ginot, whom he would rejoin after the war in Abram Varide's prayer meetings. Zapp considered the coming conflict between the United States and the Reich one to be resolved through quiet conversation between German gentlemen and American industrialists and State Department men, unquote. Von Ginot, a muscular, sandy-haired man whose dull expression disguised a chilly intelligence, quote, seems to be a very agreeable fellow, Zapp wrote to his brother who had studied in Munich with the Baron-to-be. Only second secretary in the embassy, von Ginot maintained a frightening grip over his fellow diplomats. He was an undercover SS man, the ears and eyes of the Reich Ministry of Proper Enlightenment and Propaganda, unquote. Charged with keeping watch over its secret American operations, he was, in short, the Gestapo chief in America. While Zopp worried about his legal prospects in the Indian summer of 1940, von Ginant was likely waiting for news of a major operation in New Jersey, the detonation of the Hercules gunpowder plant, an explosion that on September 12th killed 47 and sent shockwaves so strong they snapped wind into the sails of boaters in far-off Long Island Sound. Von Ginant did not approve of such gestures. So firmly did he oppose them as counterproductive, in fact, that he even attempted to denounce to Berlin the Nazi agents who perpetrated such deeds. Double agents, or worse, his faction suggested, secret Jews meant on smearing the honor of the Reich. Von Ginant's initiatives were whimsical by comparison. Once, for instance, he paid a pilot to dump pro-Nazi anti-war flyers on the White House lawn. He devoted himself to changing Goebbels' gold into dollars and those dollars into laundered donations, unquote, to the America First Committee, where unwitting isolationists, Abram allies such as Senator Arthur Vandenberg and America First President Robert M. Haynes among them, stumped for recognition of the fact, unquote, of Hitler's inevitability. Like Zopp, von Ginant considered himself a common-sense man, and Zopp simply reported the news and sold it on the wire, or, rather, gave it away, to the papers of Argentina, Mexico, Brazil, and to the small-town editors of America's gullible heartland. Zopp offered trans-ocean reports for almost nothing. In some South American countries, 30% or more of foreign news, the enthusiastic welcome given conquering German forces, the Jewish cabal in Washington, the moral rot of the American people, was produced by or channeled through Zapp's offices. On the side, he compiled a report on Soviet-inspired Polish atrocities against the long-suffering German people and distributed it to thousands of leading Americans, the sort sympathetic to the plight of the persecuted Christian. Zopp's sympathetic nature would prove after the war to be as genuine as his distorted sense of history's victims. And what we're going to take a look at now is the role of Abram Vereide, again known basically simply as Abram, in basically helping to further the networking that was being pursued by Manfred Zapp and Baron von Ginant in the pre-war period and the early World War II period prior to America's entry into the war. And we're going to take a look now at how Abram Vereide and the Fellowship were involved with helping to reinstitute fascist elements and Nazi elements in Germany. And in particular, we're going to take a look at their efforts on behalf of some elements of those elements of American power structure that were interested in a reconstitution of fascism. And veteran listeners to the program will recognize in the events that we're about to describe the presence of the Underground Reich and the networks which engendered it in the first place and which in turn have collaborated with and grown out of it and which plague us quite literally to this day. Of Abram's role in the reconstitution and rehabilitation of Nazis and fascists in Germany for the purposes of pursuing the Cold War, we read from the family, Abram was hardly alone in thinking this unwritten contract mutually beneficial. That unwritten contract, that between the former enemies of the Nazis, the American allies and other Western allies, and the Nazis themselves. Continuing, such was the deal struck by Harry Truman, the Marshall Plan, the Faustian trade of food for faith made at the hinge between wars, the one just ended, and the Cold War, which would stretch across the next five decades. But in 1949, nobody believed it would last that long. Now, Zapp wrote Abram as North Korean troops massed along the 38th parallel in 1950, quote, everybody sees clearly that a great war between USA and Soviet Russia cannot be avoided, unquote. Zapp understood as well as any Cold Warrior that the battle would be fought in faraway places. Now it is Korea, tomorrow it might be Formosa or China or Indochina, unquote. One day he feared it would be Berlin. He was skeptical of America's chances. Had not the Wehrmacht slaughtered 20 million Slavs, and still they had come, the Red Army growing in numbers, even as the ranks of its dead swelled to the size of a nation? Hitler could not stop them. German civilians thought that the Americans would succeed where the Reich had failed. Oh, the Russians can't do anything, Zapp summarized his man-on-the-street interviews, because as soon as a war starts, the Americans will drop a chain of atom bombs from the Baltic to the Black Sea and create a radioactive curtain right across Western Russia, unquote. But Zapp, who understood American propaganda and promises for what they were, knew better. Quote, this optimistic opinion sounds to me like the whispering campaigns Dr. Goebbels started at the end of the war when he spoke of new decisive weapons of which nobody knew anything. Abram agreed. The steel bath of armaments alone would not protect them. Only the solution that had saved Seattle in 1935 would suffice. The totalitarianism of God is the only answer, as one of the Cold War academics routinely trotted about by Abram had lectured a conference of diplomats in 1948. The gathering was the work of Donald C. Stone, director of administration for the Marshall Plan, a man who hardly seemed a likely candidate for a fundamentalist crusade. Stone was a blue-blooded bureaucrat inspired by noblesse oblige, one of the many authors of Europe's Reconstruction who never made headlines. But in the post-war era, he had come to believe that the West stood for Christ-like perfection while communism was, quote, hate, unquote, incarnate. Stone's ambition for the Marshall Plan was to conform the Western bloc, quote, politically, economically, psychologically, and spiritually to a global offensive of ideas, unquote. The idea for Stone was God. My main use, he told Abram, is to try to get the Christian spirit into the Marshall Plan, unquote. I have worked at that constantly. It is vital. In 1948, the newly formed National Security Council had issued a secret menu of covert actions to be pursued with Marshall Plan funds, with the only restriction being plausible deniability. Quote, propaganda, economic warfare, preventive direct action including sabotage, anti-sabotage, demolition, and evacuation measures, subversion against hostile states, including assistance to underground resistance movements, guerrillas, and refugee liberation groups, and support of indigenous anti-communist elements in threatened countries of the free world, unquote. The most important battlegrounds, Stone concluded, were the souls of the undecided who must either give their absolute loyalty or be destroyed. Stone, Zapp, Abram, just three small men in the Cold War, they might be said to stand in for the three branches of America's ideological army. Establishment Cold Warriors of Stone's ilk dominate the history books. Zapp, with the ally with an ugly past, is his dark shadow. But Abram and the influence of his fellow fundamentalists would remain invisible for decades, their influence unmarked by media and academia establishments. The role played by fundamentalists in refashioning the world's greatest fascist power into a democracy would go unnoticed. So, too, would the role of fascism, or, rather, that of fascism's ghost, in shaping the newly internationalist ambition of evangelical conservatives in the post-war era. Between the Cold War establishment and the religious fervor of Abram and his allies, organizations that came of age in the post-war era, the National Association of Evangelicals, the Campus Crusade for Christ, the Billy Graham Crusade, Youth for Christ, the Navigators, and many more, one finds the unexplained presence of men such as Manfred Zapp, adaptable men always ready to serve the powers that be. From American Christendom, Zapp and his ilk took the cloak of redemption, cheap grace, in the words of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, one of their most famous victims. To it, they offered something harder to define. This is an investigation of that transmission, the last message from the Ministry of Proper Enlightenment, the story of American fundamentalism's German connection. And what we're going to talk about here again is the role that the family played in the rehabilitation of Nazis and their inclusion in the post-World War II, quote, new, unquote, Federal Republic of Germany, and also, basically, the role of these many, or the influence of German Nazis themselves on the fundamentalist community. Basically, again, we're going to be taking a look at networking. Networking between the American power elite that had helped to finance fascism in the first place and many of whose elements were sympathetic to it, the German elite who were their business partners and ideological allies, and the American fundamentalists, which were not only instrumental, as we saw in the passage I just read, in helping to launch and to really precipitate many of the institutions that are central to contemporary American fundamentalism, but these elements in turn were inextricably linked in the networking with the Underground Reich. And the Underground Reich and Third Reich's ideas and ideology in turn have helped to shape the post-war ideological nature of much of American power fundamentalism, to coin a term. And what we're going to take a look at next is the role of Abram Varide in the recruitment and rehabilitation of old Nazis. And in this regard, we're going to take a look at his rehabilitation with and networking with some of the principal elements of German industry and finance, including Hermann Abs. Hermann Abs, arguably the most important banker in Nazi Germany and in the post-World War II Federal Republic of Germany, at least until his Nazi activities were discussed somewhat publicly in the early 1980s. Hermann Abs, as revealed in, among other books, the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, available for download for free on my website, one of the most important financial operators of the Underground Reich. Of Abram Varide's role in recruiting these Nazis for rehabilitated service in, or quote, rehabilitated service in the, quote, new, unquote, Germany, and for work with U.S. intelligence, we read as follows in The Family. In 1946, Abram undertook a mission to scour the Allied prisons in Germany for men of the predictable type, unquote, ready to turn their allegiance from Hitler to Christ and thus, in Abram's thinking, America. In later years, Abram would say he had gone at the U.S. State Department's request, and while it's true that the State Department did send Abram and provide any support he needed, it was Abram who initiated the trip, writing to Undersecretary of State Major John H. Hildering that the men of the Senate and House prayer groups had insisted that Abram carry the idea, unquote, to defeated Germany. Abram sailed on the Queen Mary in June, launched a prayer cell of Swiss bankers in Zurich, and flew from Frankfurt to Berlin on the private plane of General Joseph T. McInerney, commander-in-chief of the U.S. Forces of Occupation, to meet General Lucius D. Clay, soon to take over from Eisenhower as military governor. Everywhere he met with Christian forces of Germany, unquote, those who saw Germany's suffering as penance for its embrace of the totalitarianism of a man rather than that of God. He found them all weeping, he wrote his wife, crying for their Führer, for the thousand-year Reich and the grave at age 12, for the dead and the missing and the blank-eyed boys who had stumbled home in retreat from the Russians. In the West, he wept with them. In East Berlin, he prayed with secret cells, unquote, of Christians determined to overthrow communism. Even in the West, he believed atheistic devotees, unquote, of subversion, that is, those with strong anti-Nazi records, concentration camp survivors, had been elevated by an American military government blind to the threat that was being posed by its Eastern ally. Nominal membership, unquote, in the Nazi Party was being held against good Christians with the necessary experience to govern. A coalition of leading German churchmen begged him to intervene, asking only that none but Christians be given authority. In Frankfurt, Abram, with the churchmen and the pillars of the Third Reich to whom they introduced him, the most intelligent, honest, and reliable people of Germany, settled on a plan. And we're going to talk more about this Christian networking and that plan in Side 2 of this program. However, this concludes Side 1 of, for the record, program number 697, Christian Fundamentalism and the Underground Reich. This program is being recorded on December 13th of 2009. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.